would like now to introduce Desiree Mays. She is a storyteller. She speaks all over the world on opera. She's the author of the book Opera Unveiled, which comes out every year to accompany the Santa Fe Opera season. She gives the preview lectures nightly at the Santa Fe Opera. Welcome, Desiree, to the Radio Cafe.
Hello, Mary Charlotte.
So we're talking today about the opera King Roger by Karol Szymanowski. And this is an opera by a Polish composer in Polish.
Yes,
it's unusual.
Sort of very unusual.
At least outside of Poland.
Well, even in Poland itself, it took a while for this opera to be accepted. Chopin is the great composer we think about in connection with Poland. I think in order to understand the background of this opera, which is absolutely fascinating, it's intriguing, it's helpful to know a little bit about the composer himself, about Karol Szymanowski. He was born at a time when Poland actually didn't exist. Poland has had a terrible history. It's been run over by every conceivable country. And at the time he was born in a very beautiful estate, Timoszowka. Get that right when we do the cut. Timoszowka. It was a home where he was raised in a culture of music and concerts, and artists were always visiting his house. It was an aristocratic household. But this was in the Russian part of what became Poland. So he was raised with music on all sides. All of his family were musical. His sister became a famous singer. But he lived in terrible times. In the years 1914, it was the time of World War I, of course, and the family was virtually confined to their family estate. And then in the years that followed, he did manage to do some traveling. He went first to Germany and was much influenced by the music of Wagner. Then he went to the Mediterranean and fell in love with the culture of the Mediterranean, specifically with Sicily and North Africa. And now these were far different worlds, you can imagine, coming from the cold white of Poland to these hot climates. It also was a fact that Szymanowski was homosexual, which could never be expressed, of course, in Poland. So he lived a sort of repressed life at home all the time. But once he got to Sicily and North Africa, he became liberated in a way that actually happens in the opera as well with the leading character. So this opened up to him whole new worlds, new styles of music.
It's interesting. There's a tradition in German literature of Germans going to Italy or going to warm climes and having their sensual nature be opened up from coldness that is German culture into this warmth and naturalness and sensuality and things like that.
Haven't we all experienced this? I mean, you go to the Latin countries, Spain, Italy, Greece, and there's something, an openness, a liberation of Greece of all countries, which is so steeped in history and myth. I mean, if you never heard the myths of Greece, you get it when you're in that country. There's a wonderful sensuality about the air, about the smell of the grapes in the air. It's quite fantastic. And for all Northern Europeans, who are, of course, starved for sunshine, me included as a child in Ireland, that we had very little sunshine, a lot of rain. So we long to go to these hot climates and bask in the sun. So this is what happened to him.
Oh, and I think it's more than that as well. It's not just a matter of the climate, but it's a matter of the way of life and the attitude. And I think underlying it all is the attitude toward sexuality and eros.
Yes, absolutely. And that comes out in this opera where Dionysius becomes a leading character, the great god of wine and bacchanalia and revels and festivals. It's all in the opera. So he experienced this, and it really influenced his writing. Then on going home back to Kiev, he ran literally, the whole family were devastated when the Bolshevik Revolution happened. The family estate was absolutely ruined. In fact, most of the landowners also lost their lives. He had to find an apartment in a nearby city for them to live in. He became the sole earner of money for the family. His mother, to whom he was very close, sisters and a brother, but now they had no income. Everything was gone. The estate was gone. And he was a new, young composer, and it's hard to make a living as a composer. So life was very difficult, and he was trapped in this very hard situation during the years of the revolution, where there was murder in the streets before their eyes every other day. Very difficult. But then coming out of that, he went to Warsaw in the years that followed, and this is where then he had his major career. And at this time, at the end of the war, of course, Poland became Poland once once again. And he became involved with the new national music of Poland. So there is some of the folk sense in the music. So the man led a tempestuous life. He was homosexual. It was difficult to express that. He was a composer and had a very hard time being accepted. And then he had to live through World War I, the Bolshevik Revolution, before he could work in some sort of peace in Warsaw and in the surrounding. Zakopane was a place in the mountains that he loved, the Tatry Mountains, and that's where he lived. So this man spent much of his life in a very sort of repressed way of living. And this is in his music. And all of these influences, the influences of North Africa, of Italy, of Germany, of France, the sort of the wonderful ethereal sound of Debussy and Ravel are in his music. Stravinsky was a major influence. Remember the incredible piece L'Après-midi d'un Faun, about the faun from Greek myth that's taken off the Grecian urn of Keats, which expresses this strangeness of that whole story. That's in the music of King Roger.
Let's talk about what actually happens in King Roger. There is a character in it, the shepherd character, who is a very unusual and very compelling character. And I can't wait to see how this is done in the opera.
Yes, it's going to be great. Maybe I should back up just a little and tell you about King Roger first.
Okay.
Because whereas Szymanowski wanted the opera to be about the shepherd, he always called it the shepherd, it's probably King Roger's story because he is the one character who develops over the course of the piece. King Roger was actually based on a real life person who was a Norman, of all things. He was a Norman king. At the time that Britain was invaded in 1066 by the Normans. The Normans were going all over the place, and they arrived in Sicily. And this Roger became the king of Sicily in, looking for the date here, his date was 1130. This was apparently a very remarkably enlightened man for his time. He was educated in Greek and Latin. He had Arabic tutors. He even had a tutor who was a geographer, who was an Arab who joined his court, called Edrisi. And Edrisi is in the opera. But this is where the line between, again, fiction and the reality ends. The real King Roger was descended from the Normans. He was king in Sicily in the 1100s. In fact, built the famous Cappella Palatina, the great cathedral in Palermo, which stands to this day, and which is the setting for the first act. So King Roger was a real person, but the similarity to the real person ends at this point. The librettist was Yaroslav Ivaskiewicz, who was actually the cousin of Szymanowski and a poet, who sent him this story of King Roger. And it was based on two different sources. One was the Bacchae of Euripides, the classic Greek story of Pentheus, who follows the bacchanalian revels of Dionysius and is ultimately torn apart by the bacchanalian followers of Dionysius, and by Nietzsche's Birth of Tragedy. There was a lot of those two were the sources and the influences for this opera. Now, the shepherd who shows up in the first act is an amazing person. I mean, really fictional, wonderful dream of a person who is a shepherd and is not a shepherd. When Roger asks him in the first act, "Who are you?" he says, I am sent from a god from the Ganges. And he talks about these incredible places, and he invites people to follow his distant call. He compares himself to the good shepherd, but the good shepherd who wears a circlet of grapes around his forehead. So he's actually here. It's a fascinating line, this opening line of the shepherd's aria. He's touching on both the Christian belief of the good shepherd in certain of the sheep, and of course the Dionysian, which is God. Dionysius is Bacchus, depending on which mythology you're following, Greek or Roman, carrying the grapes and suggesting that it is Dionysius that these people should follow.
And above all, he is the essence of a charismatic person.
He is.
He's a person who walks in mm-hmm. and fills the room, and mm-hmm. everybody is transfixed. And it's rare that you meet people like that in real life, but mm-hmm. when you do, they have an energy that's palpable and inexplicable.
It's sort of, I think of it as the Deepak Chopra effect. I heard him speak once, and he does have that sort of effect. He walks in the room, and there's this sort of aura sense. I mean, great theater personalities have this, too.
Yeah.
They walk on stage and are absolutely riveted watching that person because there's something about them that draws you to them. This is the shepherd.
Exactly. But people have said that about both John F. Kennedy and
yes.
Bill Clinton, is that it's almost electric to be in the same room with. And not that, but here you have a character who is mm-hmm. clearly that kind of a person, and yet very young.
Very young.
Very
He's
beautiful.
A shepherd. He's very beautiful. Curls, golden curls, fall down to his shoulders. The descriptions are quite amazing in the original text. So the shepherd arrives, and I compare it a little bit, think of it a little as some of the great gurus that we have, who
yeah.
have the same sort of charisma. And men and women both are drawn to them. This is not necessarily it's not a sexual thing. It's a sensual, spiritual thing, which is very interesting. I mean, that's what he's exploring here, the sensuality of this shepherd along with the new religion. Of course, when he first shows up, the people who are Byzantine Orthodox Christians are frightened of him. They don't want anything to do with him. They think he should be stoned or burned to death for heresy, that he's a blasphemer. And this is what Raja also believes in the beginning. Burn him, kill him. But as the opera goes on, he brings his musicians with strange instruments, and they sit around the edges of the stage. And when they begin to play, the Dionysian dances happen, and the people are drawn to it.
But isn't there that moment, even in the very beginning, where King Roger lays eyes on this guy?
Yes.
And something happens?
Yes, yeah. Yes, that first look of being in love, falling in love, of attraction. And the director, Stephen Wordsworth, who's a wonderfully insightful director, will be directing our production. And I was very fortunate to be able to talk to him before I wrote my chapter on this opera in Opera Unveiled. And he put it very simply. He said, you know, at the simplest level, this is a story of a man who loses his wife to another man. But it's made more difficult by the fact that the husband is also attracted to the other man. That, in essence, is the essence of the story on that level. But in the level of the opera, it comes clothed in this incredible setting of the Cappella Palatina, for starters.
Well, there's also, I mean, it's not just attraction to the man, the shepherd, but it's attraction to, or what you might say, bringing out of all those qualities in
yes.
themselves. In other words, I haven't seen the opera yet, but I was reading your book, and it seemed to me about poking holes in Western culture repression.
Exactly, which was where Szymanowski was coming from. He was a repressed person who lived a good, ordered, structured life. In a way, a classical life. He was a classical musician with all of the purity that implies of the Apollonian style of thinking, of art. The great Greek statues are Apollonian. But he has repressed and kept at arm's length his Dionysian, his sensual side. He's not happy at the beginning of the opera. In fact, Idrisi, his advisor, asks him, when was the last time you kissed your wife with passion? Which is a very telling comment. He has sort of got himself locked into this orthodox, structured, king-like place, and he's not happy. He needs something more. So when the shepherd arrives, he's attracted to him on many, many levels. He's personally attracted. He is spiritually attracted. He senses that there is something more. He wants to answer the secret, distant call. But what happens in the opera is that, starting with his wife, she totally succumbs. As soon as she hears the shepherd sing, she not only sings with him, their voices blend across the rest of the court, but she goes fairly quickly, when the dance happens, the Bacchic dance of ecstasy, she's the first one to join, and Roger loses her. So through the opera, he tries to get her back, but ultimately, she's gone. She's lost, and she has succumbed totally to the sensual side of her nature. And the dilemma, of course, in the opera then is, how does one find that balance? Does Roger find it? Does she? She gives in to the sensual side and is gone. And how does Szymanowski do this in an opera? Very interesting.
Should we listen to some music?
Yes, we should. Let's start and show the contrast with these first two excerpts of the dilemma, I suppose, of King Roger. First is the Byzantine chorus. The opera opens in a darkened cathedral, and all we have is the sound of the Byzantine choir singing Hagios, Hagios, Holy, Holy. And a little anecdotal, interesting point here is that the chorus who will sing this chorale at the very opening of the opera in Santa Fe is our own desert chorale. So that's a lovely tie-in that we'll have them to sing the opening. So let's hear the very opening of the chorale in this magnificent Sicilian cathedral before we hear the shepherd song. And you can contrast, just in these two clips, the different sound and the different places they're coming from.
Listening to music from the opera King Roger by Karol Szymanowski and talking to Desiree Mays, author of Opera Unveiled. So that was the chorus that's being sung this
right
summer
at the
by,
yes,
by the Desert
by the
Chorale.
Desert Chorale. Great. Yes, it is great. So, and now to contrast this with the shepherd song, the shepherd, the archbishop tells the king and the court that the shepherd has arrived and he's preaching another religion. So he enters into the court and he sings. Listen to the difference with this. It's a very sensual, yearning sound. There's sort of a longing for fulfillment in the music of the shepherd throughout, a sense of desire. And he promises ecstasy. The music is not passionate in the way an Italian would write this, actually. There's a sort of an ethereal and spiritual sense to it. And these are the lines that the shepherd sings. He sings, adorned with a circlet of ivy, a bunch of grapes in his hand, he watches over his sheep in green pastures. My God sees his smile reflected in the water's mirror, in the darkness of the glassy waves. So it's a very sweet, calm, tonal sound with a descending line that you hear in the shepherd, quite contrasted to the first choral we just heard.
Music from King Roger. So music sung in Polish the opera's in Polish. And
yes, and it'll be sung in Polish.
Right.
Yes, and our King Roger is the great Mariusz Kwiecień, who is from Warsaw. He apparently recently bought a home, a beautiful home there, on the strength of all the work he's been doing. He's singing internationally now. He sang our King Roger, our Don Giovanni here, and he's singing Don Giovanni at the Met in this current season. He's a popular singer back there. Now, when he fell in love with this opera, when he heard it a few years ago, and he was the one who convinced our general director, Charles McKay, that this would be a great opera to do, and he would sing King Roger.
And it's probably challenging for the non-Polish opera singers in this opera.
Yeah, that's an interesting aspect of opera these days. You know, most opera singers are trained to sing Italian, French, German, maybe. Now they have to be able to handle Czech for Janáček. They have to be able to sing in Russian for Tchaikovsky. And now they are expected to sing in Polish, which is easy for him because he is a Pole. The shepherd in this production will be sung by William Burden, who was last seen here singing Captain Vere and Billy Budd, a very different role. And these two singers are light years apart in terms of their sound and their temperament and where they're coming from. And I actually,
as are the two characters.
Yeah, as are the two characters. It's perfect. And how that attraction will work. Stephen Wadsworth said that he does not believe in overlaying his operas with a lot of scenery and contemporary looks because it can overwhelm the music, it can overwhelm the plot. What he likes to do is to focus on the characters. So the action comes from their movement and their interaction and how the body language works between the characters. When you go to this opera, this is something really to look for because he is going to have a fairly bare stage, I understand. And the sets will not be the magnificent sets that Szymanowski wanted in the cathedral and then in the Byzantine Arabic palace and then finally in a Greek amphitheater. They will be suggested. But Stephen Wadsworth's focus is on the interaction of the people. So that look that you mentioned when the shepherd first comes in and looks at Roger, he says there is an intimacy. There's an intimacy amongst all of the characters, and there should be the case with all operas. It should not be sets and lighting, costumes, all enhance this. But in this case, he really wants to get down to the bare bones. So it's the interaction of the characters, especially the King and Roger, because really this opera, it could be called an oratorio. The librettist called it a mysterium. That's interesting because it doesn't fit the regular criteria for a regular opera. In a way, it's a dialogue between Roger and the shepherd throughout. That dialogue is what's important.
Well, you use the word intimacy when you're writing about it, and when you think of not having all those trappings of sets and lighting to the maximum is in keeping with this theme of stripping away all the trappings of society and getting to what is the real self, what is the real interaction between me and another person.
Yes, they're getting to some very serious, intimate subjects in this opera. All operas, of course, deal with human emotion. I mean, that's really what they're about, what we're feeling in relation to the other people around us. Jonathan Miller, the great director, once said, I'll never forget, he said, it's about the eyes. The eyes of the characters on stage should be on the character who's singing. That thereby draws the eyes of the audience. Same as in a great painting, the artist will draw your eye to a specific part of the painting. That's the bit that you're supposed to focus on and think about. That's true in this opera. So I think that aspect will be very interesting, and that's something to watch for in an opera where there's not a lot of action. Yes, there are a couple of bacchanalian dances, but they're not the wild orgiastic dances that one might expect for a bacchanalian revel. There's something very strange. There's a hypnotic sense to them. Roxana cannot resist. And what is implied, it's not just the dance, but it's the spiritual following, the return to nature, the wanting to be part of the whole, the oneness, she wants to be one with the God, whether it's sexually or spiritually, in every sense of the word, which is what happens. In the last act, when she has followed Dionysius, she appears first in a long gray cloak, and towards the end of the opera, she sheds the cloak and reveals that she's wearing the costume of a Maenad. These were the wild women followers of Dionysius, and she has become one of those.
We're talking to Desiree Mays about King Roger, the opera by Karol Szymanowski. We're going to take a break. We'll be back in just a moment. Please stay tuned. And we're back with Desiree Mays, author of Opera Unveiled, talking about the opera King Roger by Karol Szymanowski. So we have talked about the shepherd and about King Roger, but King Roger's wife is called Roxana. Let's talk about her. We're going to hear some music, which is her song.
Which is her song. And often this is the one aria that's picked out of this opera and sung in concert performances. It's very beautiful. Let's hear a little of this, Roxana's aria from the first act, when she has heard the message of the shepherd and she's concerned for Roger. She loves Roger, but Roger has closed himself away from her as well as everyone else, it seems. And she begs for mercy. She says, at least listen to what the shepherd has to say. So here's a little of her aria from the first act of King Roger. We probably should give people a sense of the recording we're using here.
Right.
There's one great recording, which they do have, I know, at the Opera Shop, and you can get online, I'm sure, too, though with some difficulty, but persevere. The conductor is Sir Simon Rattle. It's the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra. Thomas Hampson, who actually will be singing some of our Scarpias in Tosca. Thomas Hampson sings King Roger. Philip Langridge is Edrisi. The shepherd is Rizad Minkiewicz. And Elisabetta Simitka sings Roxana. So look for the Simon Rattle recording. That's the one to get. It's a haunting recording. He really gets under the skin of this piece.
Well, what we just heard at the beginning, it was so interesting to me because I want you to talk about the music itself and the influences on that music, and it had no words for quite a while.
Yes, yes, which goes back to maybe, you know, it's not words where we get our feelings from. It's from the music. I've just been talking in New York about Wagner's Ring, and the great moments of that piece turn out to be the orchestral sections when the singing has actually stopped and he turns it over to the orchestra. But here you have a sense of it in her voice. Just no words. She just sings. It's very beautiful. The contrast is here throughout within the score itself. There's no arias per se, though this one is an aria, having said that. But you get the contrast of the Byzantine choruses, the more structured, formalized style that would have been very familiar to the audiences of Warsaw at the time. And then this gradual letting go. In the dance, he uses Eastern, what we call Middle, we call Oriental, but not meaning Japan and the Orient. It means actually the Middle East. Middle Eastern sounds, those instruments, those influences are all woven into the music. So the seduction comes from there, I think. It's in the shepherd's songs. It's in the dances. And that's what draws us in, that sound. The dance is very like the dance of Salome, actually, in Richard Strauss's Salome. family. In fact, the critic said to Szymanowski afterwards, you know, where did you get the source of this piece of music? And he said, I'm proud to say it's entirely mine. I didn't get it from anywhere. So he's absolutely immersed in this. And this is maybe the only way he can express those feelings of his in this music, his own yearning and longing. So as it goes through this, through the piece, you know, Marischal, is only 90 minutes long, which is extraordinary. There are three acts. The first act is in the cathedral. The second is in his palace, which is filled with Byzantine and Arabic influences. And the music of the dances which happen in here are straight Moorish, Arabic, Middle Eastern. And then it ends up in a Greek amphitheater, which we'll get to. But those three styles are in the music.
And the three pieces run one after another without intermission.
Mm, that's right.
They flow from one to the other. There's this continuity, and you don't break your own focus.
That's right. No intermissions. In fact, this opera will be performed in one piece, though it's written in three acts. And I think dramatically that really works because it takes you from these three different worlds. But there's also really not a sense of linear time in this. There's a timelessness about it. The god is timelessness. The Dionysian is a fact of human nature. There's always been the sensual side which we give into, are attracted to, or want to know about. Roger wants to know about it, but he doesn't want to succumb to it. And maybe part of that is maybe all our fear, that when we're faced with something very sensual that we're drawn to, is a fear that if we give into this, can we go back?
Well, I have to say, to 21st century sensibilities, seems kind of silly.
Yeah, well, the way we live now, Szymanowski would never have written this
exactly.
Opera because there wouldn't be a need. Now this total sexual freedom is a fact of life. We don't have to deal with it. But are we swinging too far the other way?
I guess what I'm saying is there's so many people. It's one thing if your entire musical or artistic participation is going to a symphony or indeed an opera and sitting mm-hmm. quietly with your hands folded and not saying anything. But if you go to a concert where there's dancing and you throw down, then you release and then you go home and you go back to work the next
yes,
day.
Yes, yes. But you've,
it's you, like, you know, but I don't know anybody who's afraid of, maybe there are, and maybe where illegal controlled substances are concerned, that's another thing entirely, but you're not afraid that you're going to lose yourself. The night will be over and then you go back to your life.
In terms of performance, that's true. But in reality, I mean
in reality.
Yeah, I think drugs are a good example. And people think, oh, maybe it would be fun to, should I try? You know, there's a question about trying them. But I think there may be also at the back of the head, maybe I'll get hooked and not be able to come back. So that may be true for some people. But that's, I think, what makes this, in a sense, too, a very contemporary opera, because it's about finding this balance. That really is the bottom line, which we'll get to.
So what happens next?
So at the end of the first act in the cathedral, the king has said to Roger has said to the shepherd that he invites him back that night so that he can put him on trial, virtually. In the second act, then, the shepherd enters, but this time not as a humble shepherd. He comes in a richly gowned in this wonderful Middle Eastern costume that's encrusted with priceless gems, is what it says in the libretto. And he comes with four musicians with these strange instruments. And as the act goes through, his people, sort of half-real people, who are his followers, appear and they dance. At a certain point in this, they actually dance. We may hear a little of that. But at the entrance, the court is now assembled. Roger wants to know more. He's drawn to the shepherd. He wants to know where he's coming from, whereas Roxana is ready to go with the shepherd the moment he appears.
Desiree, why don't we actually, just for the sake of time, let's go straight to the dance.
That's a good idea. The dance, the Bacchanalian dance that's played by these strange musicians.
Thank you.
again, the Bacchanalian dance from King Roger by Karol Szymanowski. Now, I'm looking forward to just seeing what that looks like on the stage.
On the stage, yes. The dance you have to think about in terms of swirling dervishes.
Right.
That's the sort of choreographic place that this dance comes from. So the act ends as the shepherd leaves the king's palace. And in the third act, then, we are in a Greek amphitheater. We've gone to quite another scenario.
Can I just say that it's amazing that the shepherd hasn't gotten killed yet?
Yes, it is. And actually, at one point, King Roger has had too much, and he orders that the dancing stop, and he says, arrest him, tie him up, and he's put in handcuffs or whatever the equivalent was in the 12th century. But he breaks free. He breaks free of his bonds, and he says, he's angry, the shepherd. He says, you have no right. You have no power over me. I'm going back to my secret land, and I invite you to my sunny shores. And everybody leaves, and Roger is left alone on stage with Idrisi, who is advising, who is with him, sort of the calm voice throughout. And at the very end of the scene, he's seen taking off his crown, unbuckling his sword, dropping it to the ground. And you know that he and Idrisi will follow the shepherd, but as pilgrims, not necessarily as participants. So that's where the second act ends, sort of on a cliffhanger. But the final act then in the Greek amphitheater, it's a marvelous setting. On one part of the stage, there's an altar where some sacrifice has been happening. There are wisps of smoke coming up from the altar. Roger enters alone with Idrisi, and he's heartbroken. He longs for Roxana, and she has left. She's followed the shepherd, so he calls for her. And out of the night, this is also important, I think. This whole opera happens at night. It's a time of dreams. It's a time of illusions. That very first opening chorus is at the setting of the sun in the cathedral, and it's going to end with the rising of the sun the following morning. So there's the depth and darkness of night that is very important in this, especially this act. So he calls for her, and she comes, but she is echoed by the voice of the shepherd. She comes to him, and she invites him to her palace that he will lie with her on her bed, implying that he will become part of the whole Dionysian revels. He can't do that. He wants to know where the shepherd is. His interest here is the shepherd. Roxana is there, but she seems to be shadowed by the shepherd at all times. And finally, they decide that they will reignite the sacrificial fire. So they throw flowers on the altar, and the flames flare up. And then suddenly, in the center of the flames in this Greek amphitheater, in the dead of night, is the golden god of love, of sensuality and freedom, Dionysius appears. It's a fantastic moment of theater. Then the dance continues, but at the beginning, first rays of the sun, Dionysius and the dancers literally fade away. It's not clear if they are features of dreams, of illusions. You know how that happens in dreams. They're there and then they're gone. And finally, Idrisi turns and says to Roger, the delusion, the illusion is over. And Roger climbs up the great steps of the amphitheater to the very top. And he opens his arms to the rising sun, which, of course, by implication, is Apollo. And he sings this absolutely beautiful aria at the very end. So perhaps we could just go to the last track and play the aria of King Roger as he greets the sun. Let me see if I can find the words for you here and give you a sense of that. He sings, the sun, Idrisi, the sails unfurl on the deep blue sea like gulls' white wings. They sail away light and agile as the white sea spurns. The wings are spreading, they embrace all the world. From the abyss of loneliness of power, I pluck my pure heart to offer to the sun.
curtain goes down.
Yes, it
well,
does.
Of course, there's no curtain at the Santa Fe
Opera. No, but the sun comes up.
The sun comes up. Now, this, I am guessing, is a place where people will go home after the opera
and talk.
What did that last thing mean?
Yes. What does it mean? And Szymanowski left this very deliberately open ended. He said it will mean different things to different people. Does King Roger die? I don't think so. In the music, he has a newfound strength. He has observed the Dionysian rites, but he has not succumbed to them. So he knows about it, and it is as if he has decided not to give up his sensual side, but to balance it. In my interpretation, he has found a balance between his Apollonian and his Dionysian sides. Maybe the ideal that we might all want to strive for is probably very difficult to achieve. I mean, we're in one place or another at different times of our lives. And maybe that's what this is about. And I think the music certainly suggests it ends in this major key, and his voice has a newfound strength that it doesn't have in the rest of the opera. He's questioning, he's angry, he's searching, and now he has found something. And that whole symbolism of day and night, of Apollo Dionysius, of pagan and Christian, all of that feeds into this opera. It's very, very rich on many levels. So personally, I think that's where the ending may be. But that is something I would love to talk to people about. If they come to the preview buffets, come. You could call in, perhaps, or we can talk about that. That would be interesting. How did you find the end of this opera?
And there are really operas where sometimes you just, it's enjoyable, or you hate it, or you love it, and you go home. But then there are other ones that make you think for a while. There are themes like La Traviata. Can you marry somebody from the other side of the tracks and be happy? You know, that's an ongoing theme many, many people face and have always faced and will always face.
And tragedy, I think, is fascinating in opera because many of us have experienced tragedy in different aspects of our lives. We may not then have experienced it too, but we have known people who have. And it gives us an empathy, an understanding, an insight into other people's problems. Violetta in La Traviata is a good example. In the new Met production, there's a giant clock on stage and it's running down. She has tuberculosis. She's running out of time. And how is she going to deal with that? How would we deal with it? And if we were in Roger's situation, how would we try to find that balance? Have we found it?
And I think above all, it kind of is an indication that we live in a culture that doesn't value balance.
Yes, we are about extremes, aren't we?
Yeah.
Yes, if you think about that.
We're talking to Desiree Mays, author of Opera Unveiled. And before we go, I want to make sure that we tell people about some of the things that are going on. For example, besides going to the opera, you also get to go behind the scenes. There are backstage tours that people can participate in.
Yes, that's something really worthwhile doing. It's for an absolutely nominal amount of money, and you can just show up at the box office any day, Monday through Saturday at 9 a.m. there in the morning, which is great before it gets too hot. And you will be taken backstage under the stage to the scene shop, the costume shop. And depending on what's going on stage, you may be allowed on stage, but typically they are rehearsing and can watch from the side. But it gives you a sense of what goes on, what the phenomenal things that go on backstage. For instance, when these costumes, period costumes, are presented on stage, the detail that's employed in making these costumes, the people who are there, you'll hear some of the production people, the seamstresses can talk to you, the tech directors. It's fascinating. So that's every day at 9 o'clock starts on May 28th through the season at 9 in the morning. Just show up at the box office, pay this nominal amount, and you can take the backstage tour.
Now, if people are in Albuquerque or indeed in Santa Fe, there's shuttles that they can catch up to the opera.
Yes, that's right. And especially for people in Albuquerque, driving home at 1 in the morning when you're in an altered state from an opera such as this is probably not a good idea.
You have given in to the Dionysian.
Yes, you have, and you may want to drive that way, which is not a good idea. So there are shuttle buses now from Albuquerque. They leave at 6:30 in July when there's an 8:30 curtain, and at 6 o'clock in August. August when there's an 8 o'clock curtain. And you can call the box office to get the details. You have to call the box office to book. Again, it's a nominal amount, and it's well worth doing. But do book in advance because they get sold out. You can also get buses from Santa Fe. These buses will go either 2.5 hours prior to curtain so that you could go to the preview buffet or a prelude talk, or 30 minutes before the show. Again, call the box office. And the pickups are at the hotels, the Courtyard by Marriott, all the way up to Hotel Santa Fe. The last port of call is the El Dorado Hotel, and then straight to the opera. That's another very nice way. You don't have to hassle with, you know, where am I going to park my car, and you know, you're actually taken from door to door. And actually, I'll be doing a little taped reading of a recording of the story on these buses, so people can hear a little of the music and get in the mood before they ever get there. And then when you get there, you've time for a nice glass of wine before you settle into your seat.
Now, you are going to be doing a reading, is that right, in Albuquerque?
Yes, that's happening on the 25th of June, which is a Monday. It's at 6 o'clock at Page One Bookstore, which is at that intersection of Montgomery and Wantabeau. I'll talk about the five operas and play some music examples. So I hope if people are in the Albuquerque area listening in today, they might like to come and get into a little more depth with some of these operas that we're covering, Mary Charlotte.
Desiree, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
We've been speaking with Desiree Mays. She is an international speaker on opera. She's the author of the book Opera Unveiled, which comes out every year to accompany the Santa Fe Opera season. She gives the preview lectures nightly at the Santa Fe Opera. The opera season opens on Friday, June 29th. For more information on the Santa Fe Opera, you can go to santafeopera.org. You can call 505-986-5900 or 800-280-4654.